The following views presented in this half hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, and the University of California. It's 4:30 p.m. and you're listening to the news broadcast on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. I'm Camila Kudelska, and it's Monday, October the 13th. In today's KDVS news broadcast, what does the Ebola outbreak mean for international world health?
We need to increase our surveillance and public health interventions. And I would say the United States has also shortchanged public health and the infrastructure for dealing with things like this.
Also, a perspective on the effects of the minimum wage increase within ASUCD.
So I did have my job before, and after the increase, it kind of sucked for some people because there were people who were like, every year you get like a 25 cent, you know, raise, but then once the minimum wage increase went up, then everybody went up, and then it kind of like, it sucked for them, but then it was like really nice for everyone else because then everyone was like up at the same level. But I mean, I did get hours cut, so my paycheck is actually still the same.
That and more later on. But now, the weekly weather report from the UC Davis Weather Department.
Hi, Aggies. This week's weather is going to be a nice change of pace. Expect to see rain overnight on Tuesday and spilling into Wednesday morning, as well as a slight chance on Friday and even another possibility next Monday. The storm Tuesday into Wednesday could bring us up to a tenth of an inch of rain. There is still uncertainty with Friday's storm, but it will likely bring us very little precipitation, if we do get any from it at all. Monday's storm is still too far out to be certain of anything, but as of right now, it looks like it could be a strong storm. There will be strong winds associated with Tuesday's system, with sustained winds of 15 miles per hour and gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Temperatures this week will be much lower than last week's. Tomorrow's high will be 75 degrees, and its low will be around 56 degrees Fahrenheit. Wednesday will be even cooler, with a high of 70, but warmer, around 60 degrees, overnight due to the clouds from the passing storm system. Thursday and Friday will be similar with a daytime high of 73 degrees and 70 degrees, respectively, and lows around 57 degrees. Over the weekend, we will see a slight warm-up into the mid-70s. Normal highs for this time of year are in the upper 70s, and normal lows are in the mid to lower 50s. In a typical water year, we will see 1.5 inches of rain by the end of October. This year, it's looking normal with total precipitation since July 1st, totaling to 0.5 inch.
You're tuned in to KDVS 90.3, and this is a KDVS news broadcast. The newest addition to our news broadcast is Street Talk, where our reporters ask students on campus questions relative to the day, time, and current events. For today's Street Talk, reporter Mark DeDios asks students their opinions on the national holiday, Columbus Day.
Do you guys celebrate Columbus Day?
Do I?
What do you mean by celebrate?
Well, do you acknowledge it?
Here at Davis or us personally?
Personally.
Not really. I don't really like Columbus, but I mean, it's like a national holiday, so technically, kind of.
You also technically don't get the federal holiday. Get the day off.
We're still
at school right now.
I remember like in State Columbus Day or something.
Columbus Day.
Yeah, I did.
Because, I don't know, in elementary school it was a huge deal, but then you go to like middle school and high school, you learn that how... was.
I don't know.
Wait, what was? Do you celebrate Columbus?
Celebrate.
Yeah.
And if I get the day off, I'll celebrate Columbus.
Wait,
what was
that? I think it's one of those holidays that's kind of been, in a sense, really. It doesn't mean much anymore. It's like another of those sales words that are, yay, sales, more sales, day off, sales.
That was reporter Mark DeDios talking to UC Davis students about what Columbus Day actually means to them. This is a KDVS news broadcast brief update on top news of last week. This past week, the rise of Ebola has taken international attention with the United States Secretary of State John Kerry calling for the global community to be able to properly respond to this challenge, and to make sure that we protect people in all our countries. Sunday, it was confirmed that a health worker treating the first United States case in Dallas has come out positive for Ebola. We will have more on the Ebola outbreak right after this top news of last week. Hong Kong police began taking away some barricades used by pro-democracy protesters in the Asian Financial District Center Monday. The pro-democracy protesters have been occupying main roads in this area for the past 2 weeks, after an announcement by the Chinese government that a pro-Beijing committee will screen candidates Hong Kong's inaugural 2017 election for top leader. Protest leaders called for aid from supporters to reinforce all barricades by using social media. A police officer told protesters on local TV, "Today we haven't come to clear the area. We just want to clear the barricades blocking the road and take back the government's tools and other properties." You're tuned in to KDVS 90.3, and this is the KDVS News broadcast. For KDVS News, I am Camila Kudelska. For the past couple of months, the Ebola outbreak has been hot on people's mind. Ebola is an infectious disease that spreads through close contact with an infected person's bodily fluids. Dr. Bill Miller, a physician with specific interest in infectious disease and a scientific advisor to Omniboyam Therapeutics, explains how the disease can be contracted.
Ebola is called a contact spread type of infection. It spreads, in this case, from the bodily fluids of a person who is infected. And those bodily fluids can be actually of any kind. Spit, saliva, tears, vomit, diarrhea, and blood. Semen, too, by the way. It stays in the male for up to 3 months, it is believed, after the patient is no longer clinically infected.
Dr. Mark Schenker, the director of public health department at UC Davis, explains what is so scary about this disease.
It's a high fatality rate, so 60 to 90% fatality in the outbreaks that have occurred, and the fact that there's no effective treatment or prevention for it, I would say would be the two things.
This past March, the first Ebola outbreak was marked in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. 8 months have passed, and around 8,400 people are believed to have caught the disease. So far, Liberia has the highest death toll with 2,300 deaths from the virus. Dr. Miller explains what is so special about Ebola.
It's unusual in that it does not discriminate against religion, sex, race, ethnicity, values, or age. It strikes everyone. And because it strikes everyone, then it includes a high proportion of the working population, the people that do the nitty-gritty things that make a country work, like turn on the lights, run the electric plants, the water systems, transportation systems, government leaders, healthcare workers in particular, who are exposed at the highest level, are disproportionately afflicted. So that you end up with socioeconomic collapse in the type of infection that Ebola is.
The international community is reacting to the Ebola outbreak with fear that it may become an international threat. However, public national health organizations are slowly reacting to the Ebola outbreak, as Dr. Miller states.
We're in a circumstance of where we're trying to come to some understanding of what is too much and what is too little with respect to public health, between the reality of that it's a very limited thing today, balanced against the possibility that it could become one of the most horrible scourges in American history.
Dr. Schenker further highlights problems that national health organizations are facing.
Clearly more needs to be done, but also that the resources for public health and epidemic prevention have been shrinking worldwide, not growing. And, you know, some of this is because it's, you know, some of the poorest countries in the world without the resources, and some is because just the global resources for this type of thing have been decreased. WHO, invisible in this whole outbreak as far as I can tell. They're the World Health Organization, but, you know, their budget has shrunk, their mandate has shrunk, and they're not really engaged, that I can tell.
One reaction that countries have had is by trying to contain the outbreak with special screenings for airplanes coming from the areas that Ebola is becoming an outbreak. This has caused some discussion on the economic stance that will leave West Africa. But on the other hand, it has caused debate that there is not enough being done to prevent cases coming to other countries. United States specifically is beginning to fear the reality of the disease spreading in the U.S. Dr. Miller discusses this argument.
And I think that one of the mistakes that is being made by our public health officials is to not deal with the reality that Americans' perception of this disease is it's terribly frightening. Our feeling is, I talk to lots of people because of my position, and I have lots of friends, and I have loved ones too, and they're frightened because they don't even want it to get a toehold if we can prevent it. A contact disease for which there is no vaccination, if you think of it in the simplest terms, you'd say, okay, well, try to do everything you can so that there's no contact here in the United States with that disease. Our policymakers are trying to think of it in a global sense. What happens to Africa if we put in travel restrictions and travel bans? Africa will suffer. But Americans, when it comes to this level of concern, say, I don't really care that much about Africa. I want us to be protected. So this is the kind of debate that's being had now.
About 2 weeks ago, the first unknown case of Ebola came into the United States. The Liberian man had been in Liberia and returned to Dallas, Texas, without any signs of the virus. Not until a few days after returning did he start showing signs. He died last week of the virus. On Sunday, October 13th, a nurse treating the Liberian man was officially confirmed with Ebola, making it the first case of Ebola being contracted in the United States. Dr. Schenker highlights the importance for the United States to make a movement.
And I would say the United States is also shortchanged public health and the infrastructure for dealing with things like this. So, unfortunately, these things often take a disaster to call attention, whether it's a tsunami or infectious disease outbreak. All of a sudden, then people say, oh, we need to implement this infrastructure and these prevention measures.
More and more attention is being given to the international reactions of the Ebola outbreak. The European Union has officially stated that they are seriously considering following the United States example by screening airports for Ebola. Since a person has contracted the disease within the United States, it is beginning to raise attention of the top officials of the country. Today, Monday morning, President Barack Obama met with the top official aides, the National Security Advisor Susan Rice, Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell, and Lisa Monica, Obama's top aide on Homeland Security and counterterrorism issues. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also made an appearance. The White House has stated that this meeting was held in order to establish steps to make sure that the national health system is prepared to deal with an outbreak of Ebola in the United States. For KDVS News, this is Camilla Godelska.
For KDVS News, Mark DeDios. Beginning July 1, 2014, minimum wage increased statewide from $8 to $9 an hour. The new school year starting, I asked various students on the street and how they felt about the new change. Miranda Bard, a fourth-year sociology major.
Like, it just feels better to get paid more. It feels better to have a bigger number on your check.
Another individual voices similar opinion.
Yeah. My old job, I worked 30 hours a week for $8 an hour, and it was terrible. I worked way too hard. I worked at a bagel shop, and it was, like, the worst possible thing you could do. Trust me, don't do it. Don't work at a bagel shop. And now I, like, have way better hours because I'm a peer advisor, so you work 9 to 5, and I work in between classes. It's really convenient on campus, that sort of thing. I work less, but getting paid more really makes me, I make the same amount that I would working 30 hours
right.
at $8 at it. So it's better for me, I would say.
Another student who works for undergraduate advising provides slightly different opinions.
So I did have my job before, and after the increase, it kind of sucked for some people because there were people who were like, every year you get like a 25-cent, raise, but then once the minimum wage increase went up, then everybody went up, and then it kind of like, it sucked for them, but then it was really, really nice for everyone else because then everyone was like up at the same level. But I mean, I did get hours cut, so my paycheck is actually still the same.
Jeanette Perez, student manager at Campus Recreation's Mobility Assistance Shuttle Staff, provides a point.
Well, yeah, but you also have to think about inflation. Like, with people's wages going up, things are going to cost more. So,
such as the COHO food prices?
Yeah, I noticed that, actually.
Due to the statewide minimum wage increase, COHO income has increased from $4,357,000 in 2013 to a proposed and finalized $5,140,000. Nearly $647,000 more to account for the minimum wage increase, prices for COHO products have experienced a slight increase. A small order of soup from Cook's was $2.50 in October 2012,
now $2.75. A container of ranch at Chow's was once 30 cents and now 50 cents. Students' views on the street.
I don't know. I mean, I get it because we're a student. They should give, like, cut us some slack. We're students. Like, on-campus stuff, that should be kept at a lower price.
It kind of sucks because we're college students and everything's already so expensive.
Yeah.
But then, at the same time, like, the workers are getting paid a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I don't know, really.
Janice Corbett, AACCD business manager, explains further.
Yeah, so we've obviously had to increase some areas, obviously, to compensate for the minimum wage increase. And
yes.
So, but, you know, overall, I think we've really tried to do that strategically so that it's not a burden on the students that are here and on the staff that are here and the faculty that are here trying to take advantage of the coffee house pricing. I think if you look at, if you go downtown and you look at comparable pricing for salads or burritos or milk or soda or anything else, you would find the downtown district to be more expensive than the coffee house. And so when you look at it in comparison, it's still a better deal than going downtown. So
yes,
we're trying to keep that relatively stable because that's our goal, is to serve students. That's what we're here to do.
She provides further elaboration on changes within the AACCD budget for this year.
Yeah, so we've obviously had to increase some areas, obviously, to compensate for the minimum wage increase. And
yes.
So, but, you know, overall, I think we've really tried to do that strategically so that it's not a burden on the students that are here and on the staff that are here and the faculty that are here trying to take advantage of the coffee house pricing. I think if you look at, if you go downtown and you look at comparable pricing for salads or burritos or milk or soda or anything else, you would find the downtown district to be more expensive than the coffee house. And so when you look at it in comparison, it's still a better deal than going downtown. So
yes,
we're trying to keep that relatively stable because that's our goal, is to serve students. That's what we're doing.
Rylan Schaefer, AACCD controller, provides further elaboration on these cuts.
We reformed Entertainment Council.
All right.
What Entertainment Council has been struggling, and this year they're going to struggle particularly because Freeborn is being taken offline, and Freeborn is, of course, Entertainment Council's main stage.
So where would they be going to?
So now they have two options. They have the Pavilion, which is huge and very expensive to rent out. So that's really reserved for large acts, for example, Tiesto or Drake. And then we also have the Arc Ballroom. The problem with that is that the Arc Ballroom, I don't know, we'll see how students receive it.
All right.
Yeah. So we had to, I would say, cut Entertainment Council in half. We're working on a new fee initiative that we might run winter quarter.
Okay.
And what it would do is, like other UCs that have specific student fees allocated towards concerts, we would have a student fee here at UC Davis that goes directly to have a large concert. So it'd be something like, I don't know, Sun God Festival at UCSD or Bruin Bash at UCLA.
Yes. All right. How about AccuThreads? I see that has...
It's gone.
It's just gone.
Yeah. We're still working with Campus Council, the legal branch of the university, in order to make sure that the equipment that was broken, in which we've never gotten any money back for, to make sure that we either are able to get a refund on our money, or if the company's not willing to refund us, that we file a lawsuit.
The Unitrans budget experienced a slight decrease in administrative and programmatic expenses, as well as a nigh $350,000 increase due to the new minimum wage. Anthony Palmer, its general manager, discusses the future when in January of 2016, minimum wage becomes $10 an hour.
And so that's going to, you know, what happens is we've projected out what our budget is for the next few years, and it'll be a longer, we may be going back to the students and asking for a fee increase, you know, in around 2017 or 2018. The last fee increase was in 2007, so it's been about 10 years since that fee increase. So with just the increased cost of both of our labor costs and fuel costs and, you know, expanded service.
Amelia Helen provides perspective on her pay as an AACCD senator.
Well, I personally have a problem with the stipend position pay. I mean, I am on one of the people on stipend position, and I get paid $44 a week as a senator, and we work, you know, 20 hours, like, that's a lot, and so we certainly don't have enough time to, like, do all our responsibilities and have another job that will pay for that, but at the same time, and the same goes for a lot of other stipend positions, and there are people who are passionate about, you know, what they do, or they don't have, I don't know, and so it's hard to make people pick for their passions.
Can a further raise be feasible with an ASUCD? I asked Janice Corbett.
I think it will really depend. I think the association right now is in a place where we're looking for opportunities and for the association to continue to grow. And so if the revenue of the association can continue to grow, then I think ASUCD can continue to meet the demand of the minimum wage increase and all will be good. If ASUCD at some point in time can't continue to meet that increase in revenue growth, then in terms of compensating for the minimum wage, they will have to cut in some other areas. So it's a choice that will have to be made down the road, but it will depend on how much money AS can generate on its own.
That was reporter Mark DeDios reporting on the effects of the minimum wage increase within the ASUCD.
For KDVS News, this is Camilla Kadelska. This past Tuesday, the annual UC Davis Fall Convocation was held at the Mandavi Center. This year's theme for the convocation is UC Davis in the 21st Century, Educating for the Future of California and the World. In attendance was Chancellor Kategi, who delivered a speech highlighting that UC Davis students will be able to excel in the 21st century from the experience they gain at the university.
Our goal should be to make this campus a place of tolerance and mutual respect, no matter what else is going on in the world. Our goal should be for everyone on this campus to feel safe, because we have zero tolerance for sexual assault and other violence that has become all too common elsewhere. Our goal should be that this campus is always a place that values and protects freedom of speech and freedom of expression, exemplified by our own freedom of expression policy that can make this space a model for the values this community holds dear.
Other keynote speakers at the convocation were Daryl Steinberg, California Senate President, Grace Davis, the Director of California Corporate Affairs and Intel Corporation, and Senior Spanish Major Alejandra Ramirez. All three speakers focused on the future abilities and collaborations for UC Davis in the upcoming school year of 2014-2015. KDVS News talked to a couple of people after the convocation to get their point of views.
It was a good reminder of, you know, what our values are and what we as a university and as individual departments have for our priorities and our values for our offices and for our students and for the student experience. And I thought it was wonderful. And I definitely am looking forward to a great year ahead.
I thought it was great. I feel inspired. Yeah. And excited about UC Davis.
One thing I was surprised by was, honestly, we were like probably two of like eight students.
Yeah,
that's true.
I wasn't expecting that. Like, every single student got an email, all like 30,000 of them, right?
Yes.
We were two of seven. I'm a new student, so maybe I just thought, because I mean, it was definitely worth going in though. I honestly did enjoy it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I can't deliver a speech, and they did an amazing job.
KDVS News, this is Felicia Alvarez. Every day, masses of students, staff, and faculty circulate through the Silo's food venues. I wanted to take a closer look at the personalities found at the Silo and how they contribute to the campus community. Michelle Block is the owner of La Crepe. Every morning, he sets up shop at the small crepe cart nestled next to the staircase in the Silo.
How long have you been working here?
Davis since 1980, here 16 years now.
How did it get started?
I started in 1976 and I did fairs, I opened restaurants. Mm-hmm. One was in a town country village in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
And it still exists, it just moved into another place, not mine, I sold it. But I come from France, yeah? So what do you do?
Yeah, for sure.
Make crepes. Not hamburger, for sure.
Do you guys have a lot of student regulars?
We have a very mixed crowd of staff, faculty, and students. And of course, we get all the European students, yeah? Because they like to chit-chat with me, either in French or German.
La Crepe's blue European Union flag menu strikes the eye from across the Silo. What crepes stick out to their patrons?
How many crepes do you think you guys make each day?
100.
What's the most popular item, or most popular order?
Strawberry with Nutella.
Do you guys go through a lot of Nutella?
We go through three of those every day.
What's the weirdest thing you've ever put in a crepe?
Somebody asked me one time a banana crepe and insists to have onions in it.
Did you still make it?
Yeah.
What's your personal favorite crepe?
Ham, cheese and tomato.
Ah.
I eat that crepe. You know, there is a fun phenomenon with people who eat crepes.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when somebody really gets into eating crepes, mm-hmm. they usually get stuck on one.
Mm-hmm.
And they look and look, and they always come back to the crepe they really like.
After talking with Michelle, I wanted to explore other food venues and see what other students might be learning from their food experiences. The Shah's Halal food truck outside the Sala often sports long lines of students. Though Shah's was not available to interview, their customers had a lot to say.
Did you have halal food before coming to Davis?
Before coming to Davis? No, I never had this kind of food.
Yeah,
before.
What do you think of it?
It's really, really good. It's really, really good.
Yeah. Awesome. So what made you choose Shah's today?
I've been craving it for a while already.
Do you go here often?
Yeah, well, it was my first time coming since the year started, but like last year, yeah, I would come here a lot. Probably like 3-4 times a week, maybe.
So definitely a part of your week.
Yeah.
Another student perspective.
Did you eat halal food before coming to Davis?
Actually, no. Yeah. I didn't know about that even, like, really existed.
A freshman's first visit to the food truck.
What made you choose Shah's today?
I wanted to eat a food truck.
Yeah. Do you go to Shah's often?
No, it's the first time.
What year in school are you?
First year.
Okay, so was this your first time here? Have you had halal food before coming to Davis?
No.
What do you think of it?
Pretty good.
I also spoke to Star Ginger, another food truck found outside the silo, to see what impact they had on students as well.
What makes Star Ginger different than other food venues on campus?
But yeah, like we're one of the only food trucks where we're also kind of targeted to like the Asian demographic that we have on campus, which is great. You know, it's very hard to find Asian food in Davis.
Excuse me, kind of just scrolls.
Yeah, and I think it's the fact that you can find us at various different places. You know, we're always at events and whatnot. So yeah, I think that's probably great.
Indeed. The diversity in food across campus not only provides colorful options, but can serve to educate us on new types of food and the cultures that they are born from. This has been a KDBS News segment. Thank you.
That was reporter Felicia Alvarez with a review on the classic eatery in the silo at UC Davis. This brings us to the end of the KDVS News broadcast. More news can be found on Twitter, KDVS News, and website, kdvs.org. Stay tuned to KDVS 90.3 for the happenings.
Hide all the things I felt inside and all my